Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has said that he's deeply concerned about increasing violence in many parts of Sudan's Darfur region. His statement follows a series of attacks there, notably in West and North Darfur earlier this month. These incidents have left dozens of people dead, more than 1,500 houses burned, thousands displaced, and left in dire need of humanitarian assistance. In an attack on the village of Masteri on Saturday, south of Geneina, the capital of West Darfur province, some 500 armed men were reportedly involved. Condemning the violence and noting that deliberate attacks against civilians violated international law, Mr. Guterres commended efforts by the Sudanese authorities in responding to the incidents. He urged all armed groups to resolve their grievances through dialogue, particularly those who have not joined ongoing peace talks in the capital Juba. Conflict in Darfur dates back to 2003 between government forces, their militiamen, and ethnic minority opposition groups. The UN estimated that around 300,000 were killed and around 2.7 million forced from their homes. In 2005, the UN Security Council referred the situation in Darfur to the International Criminal Court after allegations of genocide there. WFP urgently seeks international support to prevent millions of Zimbabweans plunging deeper into hunger. The COVID-19 pandemic has aggravated an already severe hunger crisis in Zimbabwe, the World Food Programme warned on Thursday. In an appeal for an additional $250 million to support emergency relief for millions of vulnerable people, WFP said that by the end of the year, the number of food insecure people in the southern African nation is expected to surge by almost 50% to 8.6 million. That amounts to 60% of the entire population, the agency said in a statement, blaming drought, economic recession, and the coronavirus pandemic as reasons for the crisis. Galloping hyperinflation has meant that few families can now afford even basic food, WFP said, with the price of maize, the staple cereal, more than doubling in June. Lola Castro, WFP's regional director for Southern Africa, said that many Zimbabwean families were suffering the ravages of acute hunger before appealing to the international community to help prevent a potential humanitarian catastrophe. Roma people face intimidation, aggression, and violence, all of which have been on the rise in recent years. A senior UN-appointed independent rights expert said on Thursday, in an appeal for states to take bold measures to protect the Roma, UN Special Rapporteur Fernand de Varenis warned that hatred, exclusion, and vilification have resurfaced during the COVID-19 crisis. Citing false rumours against Roma minorities, Mr. Varenis said that they faced scapegoating and hate speech on social media platforms. This dehumanization and denigration of the Roma has led to atrocities in the past that must not be perpetuated today in different guises, he said in a statement, his comments coming ahead of Roma Holocaust Remembrance Day on the 2nd of August. The date marks the Nazis' extermination of their last Roma prisoners almost 80 years ago. Nearly 3,000 Roma children, women and men perished in the gas chambers of Auschwitz II Birkenau concentration camp. It is estimated that Nazi forces and their allies killed around 25% of all European Roma, possibly 200 to 500,000 people. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
We'll get the news up here, or get the Freedom From Religion Foundation's latest here in just a minute. I'm waiting for the screen to load. We're having a little bit of a problem, nothing short. Takes a little time for the screen to load up. The local weather, South County is actually flooded. South Jefferson County is flooded with reports of 4 to 6 inches in less than 36 hours. So it's quite a harrowing scene. Plus, Missouri, generally southeast of the metro Kansas City area, also is encountering flooding of all kinds. So it's quite a time out here in Kansas. The weather has been extremely, I guess you would call it balmy. You know, it's nice. It was hot. Got up to a 100-degree heat index most of last week, And then suddenly we took a turn, and it was as low as 66 degrees last night, Fahrenheit, this morning when we got up. So it's quite a, it's something else when it comes to weather nowadays. I don't know if you've been watching the news lately, but it's been, speaking of science versus magical thinking, we've had a bat here with who I call Dr. Demon Semen, and the Tea Party Patriot group down here out in Washington, D.C. with Donald Trump, and a number of people dying prematurely, from COVID-19, Herman Cain, the presidential candidate, as well as a leader of a organization called Turning Point USA. He's a founding member of it, and he was pronounced, he died from COVID. His name is Bill, close associate of Charlie Kirk. So I'll be writing about this in the near future and posting on Facebook and on my blog, The Fight and Cough Flyer, as well as a introductory piece for Discomfit magazine later this, I'm sure by the weekend. Here we go with Free Thought Radio, the latest one.
Is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Gaylor, and that is the singing group Buffalo Romeo singing Hang on Ruthie about, of course, none other than Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's been a true champion of the separation of state and church, women's rights, and equal rights for all. And in a few minutes, we're going to hear the entire parody of this, the song Wishing RBG, the notorious RBG, continued stamina and health.
That'll be a fun song to listen to. I'm Dan Barker. This is the July 30th, 2020 edition of Free Thought Radio. Buzz Kemper, again, is engineering from the recording studio Audio for the Arts, while Annie Laurie and I are hosting from our safer at home makeshift Audio for the Aparts studio in Madison, Wisconsin.
And Free Thought Radio is the weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and FFRF has two purposes: to keep religion out of government and to educate the public about non-theism, and we'll be talking about both of these things on today's show. If you are a member, thank you so much, and if you're not, we'd love to have you join us at FFRF.org or ask for a sample of our newspaper, which is complimentary. Just sign up at FFRF.org on our website, and we'll send you a sample.
In the second half of today's show, we'll talk with Juan Cole, the professor, author, and blogger who typically writes and comments on the Middle East and South Asia. FFRF Director of Communications Amit Pal will join us as we interview Juan Cole, who has a new translation of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, about a recent article that he wrote called Fundamentalist Pandemics, What Evangelicals Could Learn from the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam.
And of course, Omar Khayyam was very secular. Before that, we're going to speak with the South Carolina lawyer who, with an educator plaintiff, is suing the governor and the state of South Carolina to prevent it from distributing tens of millions of COVID-related education relief dollars, not to public schools, but to private, mostly religious schools. Skylar Hutto has won last week a temporary restraining order to protect taxpayers from having to fund indoctrination, and we're going to catch up with what's going on with that lawsuit momentarily.
And there's a lot of news this week, but we don't have time. We want to cover so many other things. So if you want to learn of recent FFRF legal complaints and legal victories, you can check out our current action alerts and check out our news releases at ffrf.org/news.
But there is something absolutely outrageous that we haven't had a chance to talk about before that we do want to talk about now. That is that the Sunday before July 4th, the megachurch, First Baptist Church of Dallas, held a Celebrate Freedom Sunday service that was a flagrant violation of IRS rules against politicking from the pulpit. Mega pastor Robert Jeffries, who sits on President Trump's Evangelical Advisory Board, and this is a governmental board, not a campaign board, invited Vice President Mike Pence to speak at that annual Celebrate Freedom Sunday service. And it had all the trimmings, Dan, of a campaign rally.
Well, I watched most of it. You had it on in a two-hour Sunday morning service.
They supposedly had social distancing. I didn't see it, but they didn't have as many people as usual. 2,400 people came for the regular Sunday morning service. Then it streamed live. They had a huge orchestra. They had a huge choir.
Actually, a very good orchestra.
Yes, it was a good orchestra. Give them credit. And then they had all of these Republican politicians. They had Lieutenant Governor Ken Paxton, whom FFRF has tussled with.
Of Texas.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who has told FFRF to stay out of Texas, by the way, and we have vanquished him in a recent lawsuit. Texas Senator John Cornyn, and Housing Secretary Ben Carson, who also spoke briefly, and there were waving flags, patriotic music. Like I said, it looked like a campaign appearance. So Jeffries introduced Pence first by talking about President Trump, and here are some of the remarks that he made.
And over these last 4 years, we've seen Vice President Pence working alongside our great president, and together they have been able to enact the most pro-life, pro-religious liberty, pro-Israel, pro-conservative judiciary in the history of America.
So wild applause, and then Jeffries actually praised Trump as the most resilient, the most courageous, and the most faith-friendly president in the history.
Mike Pence is a man of faith. He's also a man of prayer.
So in introducing Pence, he said other things, but this is the part that causes the most concern about politicking from the pulpit, so listen carefully.
I probably shouldn't say this, but my congregation knows that has never stopped me before. But Mr. Vice President, there are millions of Christians in this country, just like me, who are hoping and we are praying that when you have finished your term as Vice President in 2024, we don't want you moving out of the West Wing. We just want you to move down the hall a few doors and continue to build on the legacy of the most faith-friendly president in history.
So, and then not only that, but then, of course, Pence gets up and he was introduced also by Jeffries as the label that Pence himself uses. He calls himself a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican in that order. And Jeffries says, isn't that wonderful? But Pence's remarks continued to blur this distinction between religion and government, because although he did talk about his faith and religion, most of it was indistinguishable from a typical campaign stump. He talked about rolling back red tape, jobs, the economy, support for Israel, funding for the armed forces, defending the Second Amendment. and vowing to bring Texas and America back bigger and better than ever before. And all of this to rapturous applause and getting the biggest applause when he talked about sanctity of human life.
All of this in a church.
Yeah,
in a rally, but in a church.
Yeah, so the whole thing was wrong and off. And so we wrote a letter of complaint about it to the Internal Revenue Service, and we've been taking some other complaints. We have equal opportunity, a few that we wrote about some Biden campaigns too, but this is the most egregious that we saw.
And Trump has given them the green light to go ahead with this politicking.
Right, and Pence said that from the pulpit. He also said that Trump has overturned or stopped enforcement of the Johnson Amendment that prohibits tax-exempt 501c3 non-entities from using their tax-exempt donations to promote politicking.
Well, this is
and so here was a case where, yep, they're not enforcing it, so let's see what the IRS does.
Okay. Now, as we promised, we're going to listen to the parody, Hang On, Ruthie, wishing Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg continued health after she announced her new course of treatment for cancer. Ruth Ginsburg issued a statement saying, "I have often said I would remain a member of the court as long as I can do the job full steam. I remain fully able to do that."
Hang on, Ruthie, Ruthie, hang on. Ruthie, now Ruthie, we don't care what your mama, daddy do. We know you'll do your mama proud before you're through. And so I'm singing, hang on, Ruthie, Ruthie, hang on.
Buffalo Romeo singing Hang On Ruthie. They had a lesbian backup choir. And you should really go to the YouTube video to see all the visual extras. It's really fun. Photos of Ginsburg, a lot of history flashing by about her career and everything she's done for our country.
And Buffalo Romeo is comprised of the vocalist Lee Jones and Keenan Dorn. So, stay tuned. After the break, we're going to talk with the attorney who's suing the governor of South Carolina for planning to give millions of COVID-related education dollars to private religious schools.
And after that, we'll speak with professor, author, blogger Juan Cole about his recent article, Fundamentalist Pandemics, What Evangelicals Could Learn from the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam.
Come on, come on. Now hang on, Ruthie.
All night. Garofalo. Are you tired of right-wing politicians who desperately want to impose their religious beliefs on the rest of us? I know I am. That's why I'm asking you to support the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Join the fight and call the Freedom From Religion Foundation toll-free at 1-800-335-4021. That's 1-800-335-4021. Or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation website at ffrf.org. That's www.ffrf.org. Proud to be an atheist, Janine Garofalo.
As Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. This is Free Thought Radio.
We're back. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and we're delighted to have on the phone with us an attorney who has taken quick action to do something about one of the most egregious violations of the Establishment Clause that we have seen recently, which is that the South Carolina governor announced that he was going to give 32 of his $46 million COVID relief education funds to private schools. And, of course, that mostly means religious in South Carolina. And while we panicked about that, Skylar Hutto, our guest, was doing something about it with his plaintiff, who is Dr. Thomasina Adams, and immediately went to court and almost immediately got a temporary restraining order. So congratulations, Mr. Hutto, and welcome to Free Thought Radio.
Thank you, and thank you for having me. I appreciate, of course, your reference to the Establishment Clause and separation of church and state. Just as a factual background here, that is not the basis of our challenge. I'm sure you all followed this recently, the Supreme Court. There have been rulings that make those types of challenges more difficult, but what we do have in our state constitution is a general prohibition on providing using public funds to provide benefits to private institutions. So that's the basis of our claim.
So you filed in state court, and there's some wonderful wording in the constitution. No money paid from public funds or the state shall be used for the direct benefit of any religious or other private educational institution. So that was basically your basis for challenging this action of the governor, right?
That is one of the basis for it. And the other one is that there's some not only constitutional law, but jurisprudence in South Carolina that says that the state has an obligation to fund public schools. And so we've contended that using this massive amount of money to benefit exclusively private schools is a violation of the part of the Constitution that demands that the government properly fund public education.
And Mr. Hutto, isn't it true that Governor Henry McMaster had already made a statement that the public schools have to offer in-person education as well as online this fall? And then he went around and gave all this money out to private schools. And my understanding is that they didn't have to even say they would be open full time in order to be eligible for the funds. Do we have those facts straight?
That is essentially correct. Here's what I'll tell you. In his press conference, he was asked whether or not the private school had to be open in that fashion. I believe he said that the funding was not conditioned on it. You go back to that press conference. It's widely available to get the exact wording. But with respect to his actions on public schools, he did make it very clear that he wanted public schools to be open 5 days a week and to allow for online learning, whatever parents preferred for their particular student. And he does not necessarily have the authority to order that. But what we have seen is when, for example, the governor's school indicated that they were not going to be open 5 days a week and were going to favor virtual learning, he took some retaliatory action against the school. So there's clearly a policy goal on his part to have schools be open 5 days a week.
And yet they have enormous financial needs scrambling around to make this possible, and he's not giving them the same funding. And your this lawsuit, your complaint is very strong. It's taken. Is it taken just in one county?
It's filed in one county, but it has the circuit court has the power to enjoin that statewide, at least for now. One discussion that you'll see that the court undertakes is that if this restriction continues from the court on the governor, this may end up in our state Supreme Court relatively soon.
So I believe your plaintiff is an educator, and I wondered how could you get this lawsuit filed so quickly?
Well, we're lucky to we live in a small community, a tight-knit community, and through our firm, we have the privilege of knowing a lot of people, whether they be teachers or any other occupation. And so Dr. Adams is somebody we're familiar with at our firm, and asked if she was making statements that this was something that she was interested in. And during the course of that discussion, we decided that she would be a good plaintiff for this action.
So Dr. Adams lives in Orangeburg County, South Carolina, and your complaint lays out the discrepancy about what would happen for kids in public schools in Orangeburg County versus private schools. Can you explain that?
Sure. And we went into this a little bit today at the hearing, but there is data available from our State Department of Education that shows, of course, how many students are enrolled in a given school district, and also shows how much COVID emergency relief they're getting from the federal government. And so if you took where I live, Orangeburg, every student is getting a little less than $500 through their district in terms of emergency relief. But that number is relatively high, actually, compared to the rest of the state. In Greenville, the per pupil benefit is $250. In Florence, it's $280. In parts of Richland, which is where the state capital is, it's less than $150. A school that received one of these grants would receive $6,500 for a single pupil. So it is a massive discrepancy.
Yeah. So I think you say it's 13 times more money for a private school than a public school. And the public schools are what, serving 90% or more of the state's children. So what's wrong
Correct.
With this picture?
Well, I think you've identified it. There's a policy goal on behalf of the governor and apparently some legislators. He referenced them in his initial press conference, that they want to use this as a test case or feasibility study for future legislation that would create more funding for private schools in this fashion. And so right now it's 5,000 students, up to 5,000 students that can receive these types of grants if the governor's plan goes forward. But in the future, if you would ask me, it's a way to allow people with high access to information to siphon off money that should be used for public education and put it into the hands of private schools. And our expert opined on that today as well.
So the hearing today was on a temporary restraining order. And if I got the facts right here, you filed your complaint, and was it the next day that the judge granted the restraining order?
Yes, this is a circuit court judge, so it was somebody local to our community, and luckily we were able to get in touch with him on a relatively quick basis.
Because they might have distributed the funds really quickly, and then what could you do? You would have no
relief.
Well,
then that was part of the theory, was that it needed to happen quickly to prevent any type of negative and irreversible action.
So the money doesn't go actually to the student, does it? Does it go to the religious or private school?
Goes directly to them, yes.
Yes,
it goes directly to the school, so it would go from our state treasury to the school's bank account.
Yep.
Wow.
Well, we are almost out of time. A final word on what will be next?
Let me say this. We don't know exactly what's going to happen, but we're really grateful for the support of all of the public educators and public school parents. Everything that they have communicated to us is giving us energy to move forward. So wanted to say thank you to them, and we're going to keep fighting. We expect we can't know exactly when the judge will make his decision. It's currently under advisement or consideration with him.
Well, I want to thank you and Dr. Adams for your gallant fight here. Thank you for standing up for public education and for joining us today.
Scott.
Skylar Hutter, who is an attorney in South Carolina. So stay tuned. We're going to take a break, but after that, we're going to speak with professor, author, and blogger Juan Cole about his recent article, Fundamentalist Pandemics, What Evangelicals Could Learn from the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
Stay tuned for more Free Thought Radio.
Hi, I'm Steve Pinker. In my book, Enlightenment Now, I show that the world has become a better place as reason has been overcoming superstition and tribalism. But the values of the Enlightenment are under attack. That's why I'm a proud member of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest association of free thinkers working to keep state and church separate. Please join me in supporting the Freedom From Religion Foundation to ensure that our government is driven not by religion, but by reason.
Beware of dogma. This is Free Thought Radio.
I am Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. And to help us host our interview with Juan Cole today, we are joined on the phone remotely by Amit Paul, FFRF's Director of Communications, who formerly worked at the Progressive Magazine. Hello, Amit.
Hello, Annie Laurie.
And I wanted to say, although I often talk to you, we haven't seen each other since March.
Yes, although, it's been that long. Yes, yeah, it's been that long, absolutely, yeah.
Almost all the staff is working remotely. So, but you're working hard. And so, Amit, you have met our guest today, so we were hoping you would introduce him.
Yes, Professor Juan Cole is the Richard P. Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan, and a prolific commentator on the Middle East and South Asia. And he's the conjurer of this very, very popular blog, Informed Comment, that he's been writing since 2002, that's made him one of the foremost public intellectuals of our time. It even caught the attention of the CIA. It's that popular. Uh-huh. And he's written a good number of books. And it's been my pleasure to meet Professor Cole a number of times. The first time he dropped by the Progressive office when I used to work there, and we bonded over the fact that his dissertation, which was his first book, is about this kingdom where my roots are back in India, in northern India, Awadh. And he wrote about that. We bonded about that, about a bookstore in the state capital, that's, alas, not functioning anymore. And then later, I actually went to the University of Michigan to interview Professor Cole about his new book, then The New Arabs, that we'll be talking about a bit during the interview, and a whole range of issues at the time, back in 2015.
So, let's proceed.
Juan Cole has, as I said, authored many, many books and articles, including on Egypt, Napoleon's Egypt invading the Middle East, colonialism and revolution in the Middle East, and the New Arabs, which we'll be talking about a bit. But the book that we'll be concentrating more on is his most recent one, which is a translation, actually, of the famed kind of, you know, this collection of poems, The Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. And the book's title is The Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, A New Translation from the Persian. And what caught our attention a few weeks ago was an article that Professor Cole wrote, which appeared on Bill Moyers' website. Yes, that Bill Moyers, the legendary journalist. And the title was Fundamentalist Pandemics, What Evangelicals Could Learn from the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. So we'll be focusing on the book and on that article. And welcome, Professor Cole. It's such a pleasure to have you with us.
Well, thank you so much, Amit.
So what can evangelicals learn from the 12th century Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam?
Well, the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam is a book of Persian poetry. And what's remarkable about it is that although probably most of it was composed in what is now Iran, it is critical of certainly kind of conventional religiosity. We think about Iran nowadays as a center of religious obscurantism and fundamentalism. But Iran is a great civilization and is has had all kinds of movements through history. And this poetry is a kind of subtle witness to, I would say, secular and skeptical points of view that existed and were popular in medieval Iran. And I'm quite sure that the authors of the poetry would have no time of day for contemporary fundamentalism.
Now, I think before we go on, and there's three hosts, I don't want to interrupt anybody, but I think what makes this so timely is, and something that I didn't know and learned through your article, is that there was a pandemic during the time of Omar Khayyam. It was the Black Death. And so he was partly addressing this in his poetry. Is that right?
Yes, there were, during the time the poetry was composed, and I think it was composed by many hands over time, but during the time the poetry was composed, Iran was struck by a number of disasters. One of them was the Mongol invasions. They were a pastoralist people from East Asia who came into Iran and conquered it, sometimes with great brutality. And so there was a lot of death and destruction around during the time the poetry was composed. And then in addition to that, in the 1300s, the Black Death broke out throughout the greater Mediterranean area, including Iran. So, yes, this poetry, you know, the poetry is very, very straightforward that heaven and hell are fairy tales for children. That it doesn't really think that there's anything after this life. And it doesn't counsel despair at this realization, but it does counsel that you may as well enjoy yourself a little bit while you're here. Don't be mean to people or overly selfish, but you know, if a nice glass of wine comes your way or a beautiful pair of lips, don't let them pass by. So it's the opposite of the kind of puritanical religious point of view.
So, Amit, I'm going to lob the next question to you.
Yes, Professor Cole. I mean, it's kind of interesting that in your piece you focus mainly on two countries, Iran and the United States, which on the surface may seem quite different. They, of course, have, you know, the major religions in both countries are certainly different. But how would you compare and contrast these countries and their response to the pandemic and how it's been informed by religious fundamentalism?
Yes, actually, I think the United States and Iran are a lot more similar than either country would like to admit. In both countries, there's a powerful influence of literalist or fundamentalist religion, and many policy decisions are taken that are quite irrational on the basis of religious theology, religious ideas, you know, we in the United States have the big abortion debate. Ironically enough, the Iranian clerics are not as concerned about that particular issue. But we've seen in both countries very powerful arguments against closing religious ceremonies during the pandemic. And in both cases, religious forces have argued that religion trumps other policy considerations. They've often argued in both countries that God, the sacred, the divine, will protect worshipers from the consequences of these gatherings. And they've put pressure on the government, sometimes holding demonstrations, to keep religious meetings open. And this is true in California and Texas, in Louisiana and Florida. It's also true in Tehran and Qom.
Certainly is. It's what our legal staff has been doing a lot of work on during the pandemic. It's really all over the country in so many lawsuits by churches. And what about Brazil?
Well, Brazil has something of the same problem, although there's a twist here, because the majority of Brazilians are Catholics. And at least the upper hierarchy of the Catholic Church, the Pope and the bishops, actually believe in science. And so they have been willing to close religious gatherings during the pandemic, but have been opposed in this by the president, Jair Bolsonaro, who is an evangelical, not a Catholic. And there is a powerful evangelical movement in Brazil, especially among the poor. I once visited a slum in Rio, and I asked, you know, about the local culture and religion, and my friend who was showing us around said, "Well, look out over here. The slums in Rio are up in the hills." And he said, "Everywhere your eye can see, there are Protestants." So it's the evangelicals in Brazil who have, and including the first evangelical, the president, who have pushed back against any state interference in these religious gatherings.
So we're going to take a break. We're talking with Professor author Juan Cole about his article, Fundamentalist Pandemics, What Evangelicals Could Learn from the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. I'm Dan Barker here with Amit Pal and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Stay tuned for more Free Thought Radio.
I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no religious body seeks to impose its will, directly or indirectly, upon the general populace.
Let's restore respect for America's secular roots. Help the Freedom From Religion Foundation defend the wall of separation between state and church. Join us at ffrf.org. Freedom depends on freethinkers. Protect the First Amendment. It protects you. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker. Annie Laurie and I are co-presidents of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. And the director of communications for the Freedom From Religion Foundation is Amit Pal, who is joining us as a co-host today. And Amit, do you want to inform our listeners again who our guest is today?
Yes, our guest is professor and author Juan Cole, who is professor of history at the University of Michigan, a very prolific and prominent commentator on Middle East and South Asia. And we're talking with him about a recent article of his, which was originally, as he reminded us, on tomdispatch.com and then was republished on Bill Moyer's website. It is What Evangelicals Could Learn from the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. And the reason that Professor Cole wrote this piece was partly because his most recent book is a translation of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam from Persian. And Professor Cole will be delighting us by reciting a verse or two from his new translation.
Yes, this is a stanza that critiques astrology, but I think it's critiquing astrology as a way of criticizing religious superstition. The poem goes, "Don't blame the stars for virtues or for faults, or for the joy and grief decreed by fate. For science holds the planets all to be 1,000 times more helpless than are we."
Wow, that was in the 12th century, more or less, wasn't it?
Yes, yes.
Wow.
And, you know, the original Omar Khayyam, who may not have written this poem, but it's in his voice, was an astronomer. And astronomers know that it's silly to think the planets control your fate, because we're the most complex things in the universe, and we don't know where we're going to be next year this time, any of us. But we know exactly where Mars is going to be next year this time. We can figure it to the second.
And, of course, the Rubaiyat is a favorite of many secular authors and activists, and people like Mark Twain, Thomas Hardy,
and Clarence
Robert
Darrow.
Frost, yeah, Jack Kerouac was a fan. So fun to have a new translation by you.
Thank you.
And Professor Cole, you've written on such a wide range of subjects, and a book of yours I have really admired and I interviewed you about is The New Arabs. And the full title is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. And one of the central themes of the book is how the young, the Arab youth, is becoming more and more secular. Could you please talk a bit about that?
Sure. Well, the opinion polling that's being done in the Arab world among youth, and most of them are Muslim, although there are Christians in Egypt and Lebanon, shows a steady progression of the youth towards more secular ideas and less investment in religious fundamentalism. So they don't pray as often. They don't listen to the Quran as often as their elders. This has been something that's been going on now for some time. And in some countries like Tunisia, I think there are probably more secular-minded people than there are in the United States. And this is also true in Lebanon in a big way. And it's not possible to do this kind of research in authoritarian regimes like that of Iran. But the indications are that the younger generation in Iran also has been rather put off traditional religion by living under a theocracy, so that the people who are bossing you around are claiming to do so in the name of God. And so there's a very lively underground among Iranian youth, heavy metal music and parties that, let us say, the clerics wouldn't approve of. So this is something that's going on throughout the Middle East. And since the American press, American politicians are kind of obsessed with Islam and with religious fundamentalism as, you know, the keynote for anything to do with the Middle East. It's important to remember, you know, it's an area with 400 million people and it's very diverse. And there's a new generation of urban educated youth. Well, look at the world quite differently than their elders. And then there is a tradition which has been sidelined. That is to say, it's been there, but people just haven't paid attention to it, of the secular left. And so the Egyptian leader, Gamal Abdel Nasser, was left of center. A lot of Egyptian nationalists followed him. There's been communist parties, the Ba'ath Party in Iraq, which was authoritarian and horrible in many ways. It also refused to put Islam as the religion of state in the Iraqi constitution of that time. So these movements continue to exist, and there are a lot of what I think of as red diaper babies in the Arab world. You know, the parents had been on the left. The parties were destroyed, and so there's no institutional structure for the youth to continue with that political organizing, but their ideas are left of center and secular minded.
Oh, that's interesting, Professor Cole. When you talk about movements, what comes to mind, to my mind at least, in the Arab world, is the most significant movement in the past decade or two, or perhaps in the post-war era. And of course, I'm talking about the Arab Spring, which was to a large extent a secular youth-led movement. Where is it at now? Could you shed some light on that?
Right. Well, I think the Arab Spring as a political project failed, of course. The authoritarians came back. The Egyptian officer corps made a coup and ensconced itself again. And Libya fell apart. Yemen fell apart. And Tunisia is really the only, somewhat success story among them. But with regard to cultural change, there are two big achievements in a place like Egypt, which is they were turning into kind of republican monarchies. The presidents for life were going to put their kids in power after them. That's over with. That's not happening. And the other big achievement was there was a very strong fundamentalist movement in each of these countries, which aimed to take power and establish an authoritarian fundamentalist regime. And that's been put paid to for the most part. So I don't agree with the way that it was done. But in Egypt now, the fundamentalists are really under pressure. Although, people go to mosques and people practice Islam and so forth, but political Islam, the idea of having an Islamic regime, that really has fallen by the wayside. And I think the youth in particular were disgusted by the rise of the so-called Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, the ISIL, which was a very brutal movement and really was only able to come to power because the Bush administration had destroyed the government in Iraq. But in the wake of its defeat, a lot of youth, according to opinion polling, have turned away from political Islam. And even in Saudi Arabia, which used to be one of the primary champions of political Islam, a new generation is now coming to power. And while they are, again, authoritarian and not admirable with regard to their human rights ideas, they're cracking down on religious groups which are trying to dictate people's lives. And I live to see Saudi Arabia have rock concerts at Jeddah and Mariah Carey singing there and mixed gender crowds. And I have to tell you that throughout the 20th and into the early 21st century, this was unimaginable. So clearly, there's a new generation, and things are changing in the region.
Well, so they're making a circle back to the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam and that philosophy. And with that, we have to thank you, Professor Cole, for writing that book, for your insights, and for joining us today on Free Thought Radio.
Professor Juan Cole. Yeah.
And also thank you, Amit Paul, for joining us as hosting today.
Thanks, Annie Laurie.
Well, that's our show for today. Very interesting, very informative. We want to thank our producer and engineer, Buzz Kemper. The show is recorded here in our audio for the Apart makeshift studio here in Madison, Wisconsin. Thank you, listeners, to WRFI in New York, to WOOL, Black Sheep Radio in Vermont, New Hampshire, to KOPN in Columbia, Missouri, to KEOS in College Station, Bryan, Texas, WADR in Janesville, Wisconsin, WIDE and WMUU in Madison, Wisconsin, and listeners to WOOMLP in Philadelphia, heard in Philadelphia and New Jersey. If you like our show and you're one of the podcast listeners, one of the 6,000 or 7,000 listeners, give us a thumbs up on your podcast provider. And tell your friends to connect with our show at ffrf.org/radio.
And please connect with us at the Freedom From Religion Foundation by joining us, if you're not already a member, at ffrf.org, or ask for a sample of information, our newspaper, a brochure about the many achievements to keep religion out of government by the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Just there's a link at our website homepage. Tune in next week for more Rational Radio and Blasphemous Broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
I hope someday.